Welcome to Gay Mystery Podcast, featuring interviews with renowned LGBTQ authors and up-and-coming talent of mystery, suspense, and thriller novels. I'm your host, Brad Shreve, and Justine Adamick is here with her weekly recommendation. Welcome to the Gay Mystery Podcast, and before we get started, let's hear from Justine.
Hey, Brad, was that a different intro I heard?
It was a different intro.
And it
was subtle, but it's important.
Okay. Tell me more. Tell me more.
Okay, woman who obviously likes Grease. The intro was changed from writers of LGBTQ mystery, suspense, and thrillers to LGBTQ writers of mystery, suspense, and thrillers. That is what makes it significantly important.
Moving your modifier around, Brad.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
So what does that signify?
It means from this point on, we will only be interviewing queer writers of crime.
Cool.
And we're not going to get into the argument of whether straight people can write good queer novels, because they can. Some have been on this show. This changes the focus and promote a segment of our society that has traditionally been marginalized. Plus, it's my promise to our listeners that they will see our guests will be more diverse in many ways.
Yeah, I think we're going to span the LGBTQ spectrum more than a lot of other places.
We've already started, and we'll continue moving forward with that.
Yeah, I think that's terrific.
Well, good. I'm glad you feel that way, because it was an important change. And our listeners may notice the website has changed. Those of that have been with us for a while will see that changed back to the original website, which gives a little more detail on each guest. And that's where the best place to find our show notes is. And then I have an interesting announcement, or I don't know if it's interesting, but an important announcement regarding social media.
Okay.
I'm dumping Twitter.
Yeah, I could see that in this day and age.
Yeah, I'm not closing the account, but you're not going to see us in there very often. And the reason is Twitter is, first of all, it's a major battleground.
Yeah.
And I found that to get noticed just requires a lot of work. Same thing with Instagram, requires a lot of work, and I can't do both.
And right. It
feels like we get more traction from Instagram. So we're going to no longer be on Twitter, but you can find us and our promotions on Facebook in the Gay Mystery Thriller Suspense Fiction group. And then on Instagram, it's Gay Mystery Podcast.
Sounds great. Sounds wonderful.
So goodbye, Twitter, for now.
And the Patreon account went away, correct?
The Patreon account went away because our host gave me a screaming deal because I did some special things for them. And because I'm not here to make money, I was doing it just to defray the cost. That cost has been defrayed already. So Patreon has been closed.
Great. Then they get to have all the material in this free version.
That is correct.
Excellent. Well, since we're shifting, kind of summarizing where we've been and looking forward, I thought I would make sure that people knew about a few new novels by people that we've already given reviews about or recommendations of. Olivier Bosman has a new novel out in his D.S. Billings mysteries, their Victorian stories. That's called A Glimpse of Heaven. Darren Amoitse, we reviewed his The Stuffed Coffin, and he has another book out called Till Death Do Us Part. Gregory Ashe has finally finished his latest Harrison and Summers series with The Keeper of Bees. If you're a fan of him, this is well worth waiting for. David S. Peterson has a new book in his series, the Heath Barrington series, called Death Overdue.
I think everyone you listed has been on the show or is going to be on the show.
And we've also recommended, at least in the Best of 2019 series, but I think most of these have gotten a full book recommendation from us.
And it's a good chance we'll see them in our 2020 recommendations.
Yes. Looking forward to that.
So, but I have Olivier Bosman and Dieter both scheduled to be on the show. I even have Gregory Ash already scheduled to come back next year.
Wow.
In 2021.
Wow.
So, because he'll have a book coming out. I won't give the date because I'll let him do that.
Sounds good.
As far as when the book's coming out. So anything else?
That's all we have for this week.
That's all I've got. Let's get rolling with our new format.
Okay.
Interact with other crime fiction fans and authors in our Game Mystery Thriller Suspense Fiction group on Facebook. Links are on our website, GameMysteryPodcast.com. My guest is my friend Ari Bradshaw. She's a four-time Lambda Literary Award finalist in mystery and 2013 Rainbow Awards first runner-up for Best Lesbian Novel. A native of North Carolina, the setting for the majority of her novels, Bradshaw now makes her home in Oklahoma. Welcome back.
Thank you for having me, Brad. Glad to be back.
And I gotta say, the reason I brought you back is we're going to talk about the same book, Emendari. And I don't get to read a lot of the books that we have on the show because that's all I would do. But I did read Emendari, and it's right there at the top of my favorite books last year. But I wanted to bring you back not for that reason, but because even though it's a mystery novel, it delves deeper and much deeper than that. And I wanted to give you a little time. We'll talk about the mystery, but then I wanted to give you some time to really talk about what the story behind the story or what the story really is.
I'm glad to be able to do this kind of, usually when you do an interview, it's quickly about the book real quick and you hit the high spots and about what you like to do and how you write. But this is the first time I've been interviewed where we're going to do a really deep dive into the book. And I really appreciate that.
Let's start by doing the usual and just give a brief synopsis of what the book is about.
Well, it's a Southern reckoning. That's what I call it. It's because it has such a Southern flair. It does take place in an imaginary county on the coast of North Carolina with all the history that comes with it. So I have been calling it a Southern reckoning for the death of a young black man, which in this story, the death takes place in April 29th of 1979. But the book is one of those where I know people are like, no flashbacks, but it's not really flashing back. You're actually living it. You're going back with her into the 70s when she was a child. The person that comes back, her name is Jane Smith Doe. Her father's name was John Doe. Doe is a family name that goes back to colonial Virginia, and actually did the research to make sure that was absolutely true. And they live in a place called Doe's Ferry. And her father thought it would be funny to name her Jane Smith Doe because she would be anonymous for the remainder of her life. So that was a kind of an inside joke with me. I really like that name. And then I found out somebody else was writing books with a character named Jane Doe. So sorry about that. Very sorry. This is the desegregated South with its prejudices and its privileges still very much intact. Emendari, the name, is a Latin verb. It means to make amends, to correct, and restore. Jane Smith Doe is summoned back to the land of her childhood bonds and the origins of the demons that haunt her still. One of the characters asks her about her history, and she says, which past? The part where we were cradle to grave friends, all of us? Or the part where one of us died, three of us lied, and one of us went to prison. And I'll leave the rest of it for you to figure out when you read it. But it is one of those books that flashes back to the 70s. But I had to do that in order to answer a question that was repeatedly asked the year that I wrote this book. And all of my friends and all over social media, people were going, where have all of these haters been for the last 20, 30 years? Mm-hmm. And I just smiled and said, we grew up with them. They are us and we know them. And you find out about that in this book.
And you said you wanted to read a passage from the book.
And this will pretty much set the table for you. The main character this is where you're introduced to her and her friends, her gang of friends. And this is chapter two, the beginning of chapter two of Emendari. Sin is always attractive. Jane Doe, you know I can't kiss a black boy. It's in the Bible. It's 1972, Cindy. No one cares about what it says in that old book about black boys kissing white girls. Don't y'all study civil rights in sixth grade? William Malachi Blunt Jr., the black boy in question was my friend and my third half cousin. It's complicated. Malachi and my dad shared a great great grandfather, but not a great great grandmother. Skin colors and races meant a lot more to other folks than it did to two kids grown from birth together. I was barely a month older than Mally. We hadn't known there was a difference between us until we started school. Now at age 11, it had been made clear to us that people didn't see the world like Mally and me. And that's kind of the flavor of the book. It's a young white girl and a young black boy that grew up together. And some bad things happened to a lot of people in the book.
So why did you choose that particular passage?
Because it speaks to the South that I know. It speaks very, very loudly to the South that I know. Have you ever watched that show, Finding Your Roots, with Henry Louis Gates Jr.?
I've heard about it, but I haven't watched it.
It's a genealogy, and he focuses a lot on children of whose ancestors were slaves. And what he found in the DNA is that there is such a mix of bloods in the South, and there are so many. It's the mixed races in the South that is people want to deny it, and it is the ugly stain of slavery. That's what it is. It's guilt. It's Southern guilt. It's a curse. Faulkner referred to it as a Southern curse. Slavery will always be there. It's always going to be in our faces. And we have to start acknowledging the damage done and the damage that is still being done. It can't be, you can't say, my favorite thing to say to people who say, well, my folks didn't own slaves. You probably don't really know for sure until you look it up. I looked it up. My folks owned slaves. Part of my family owned slaves. Part of them were Quakers that didn't own slaves. It's just in the South, if your family had property, they probably owned a slave. Just go ahead and get right with that. But they'll say, well, my family didn't own any slaves. And what I say to them is, even if your family didn't own any slaves, for 200 years, the United States imported people in North America, imported people from Africa for 200 years. And what were your white ancestors doing during that 200-year period? Whatever they were doing it, and they were freely allowed to do it.
You had mentioned to me before, you said, I'm Southern and proud and yet embarrassed by my family history. I found that very interesting.
You know what? We have to admit that we have a family history that can be scarred. And Maya Angelou used to say, when we know better, we do better. And my goal with my child was to do better than was done to me and was done to my parents and their parents and their parents. We come from a long line of things that are distasteful and disgusting. I know I told you this, the story of finding out that one of my ancestors had six children. And he had five slaves, and one of the slaves was pregnant. And in his will, he gave away the baby that wasn't even born yet. So each child got a separate slave. I mean, how disgusting is that? That it makes you want to throw up. It really does. I just sat there and stared at that paper like I didn't know quite how to process that.
It's disgusting, yet it's amazing to think that that was normal for them, that somebody would find that okay.
Right. It's really hard to fathom. It's completely, I don't know how to explain it, but what I do know is that I will spend the rest of my lifetime, trying to make sure that I honor the memory of the people that were enslaved and that I do what I can to make sure that I recognize the privilege that I was given just being born white. You know, people are like, well, I didn't ask to be born white. Well, you were. So you have to live with it. You can't say that you don't have a privilege. It wasn't that long ago that it was against the law to teach a slave how to read. And at that same period of time when it was against the law to teach a slave how to read in North Carolina, I had doctors and lawyers in my family. That means that people went to college. There are so many layers of privilege. You have to just keep peeling back the onion and looking at all the reasons. From the moment I was born, it was expected that I was going to college. There was never any question about whether I was going to college or not. And people that don't, one of the things about this book that I've gotten several emails on, so it must have hit home with a lot of people, is that the America that they grew up in was not necessarily the America that the rest of us grew up in. And that your middle class perspective on things is not the same perspective people had down at the trailer park. And it's not the same perspective of a white child in the backseat of a station wagon riding through a county that I lived in and knowing that we were going through, well, this is where the black children went to school. They didn't go to school with us. And it wasn't until the late 60s that we desegregated and went to school. We were the first generation to desegregate and go to school together. And I don't think that's the experience some people had. I don't think that finding out that we were so different, that was the weird part.
So my question is, how does this apply to writers of this genre, crime fiction?
Well, we spend a lot of time in crime fiction, for sure, in the neighborhoods of marginalized people. And are we doing marginalized people a disservice by continuing dangerous tropes of, say, the black trans sex worker, who is either the smart mouth clue giver or the victim? And we don't give them three-dimensional lives. We take the easy trope, and we should try to at least put some trans people in some police uniforms, or, you know, the owner of the business, or the, you know, we don't have to all, trans people don't always have to be sex workers. They don't always have to be victims, and they don't always have to be the perpetrators. Another thing is, black crime writing started in the early 1900s. You'll find those crime novels in their periodicals that were basically for the black community. Newspapers, because white publishers wouldn't publish black journalists. They wouldn't publish black writers very often. You know, we have one of those. Thank you very much. We don't need any more. We have one. That kind of stuff was going on. So they published themselves. The black community published themselves. And those books were the first time that people were able to see themselves in the books as the solvers of the crimes, not the committers of the crimes. And these books, these beginning detective stories, set the groundwork for most of what we see in detective and crime novels today in the black community. It's been expanded on, but the culture is deeply embedded. The movement, the language, the music, it's all something that we tend to, as white, I'm just going to say me, because I don't want to make assumptions about other people. I have tended to write about the black America that I've read about my whole life that was written about by white Americans. Does that make sense?
That makes perfect sense.
It shouldn't, but it shouldn't make sense. I shouldn't be writing about black America that I read on, you know, Harper Lee, Tennessee Williams, Mark Twain, Faulkner, even Dorothy Allison. They've all written about the South and from a white perspective. And we tend to continue to write those same stories. And I think it would behoove us to do the work. It would behoove us to, most writers use beta readers, a group of readers who read their work before they publish it, give them feedback. If you're writing about black people and you're not asking black people to give you feedback on your book, you're already I just wouldn't do that. I wouldn't do that. I wrote a book about Native Americans. I went to the Native Americans here in Oklahoma that I was writing about. I went to them and spent time with them at their museums and in their just with different members of the tribes, talking about what I was writing about, and then gave the book to members of the tribes to read before I published it. And I spoke with somebody who wrote a book about the Sioux a Sioux Native American, and she had not presented it to anyone in any tribe to look at. And I was just dumbfounded by that. So I think we really need to do the work.
Okay. And so I said we were going to get deeper into the book. And okay. We kind of have. It is a mystery novel. There is a mystery. Yes. But what specifically in the book is there that is in relationship to what we're talking about?
This book grew out of a very sad memory, an actual event that happened to someone that I cared about when I was growing up. I was 12 years old. A younger friend, he was 11, went down to the ferry dock, and they found his body later that evening. I have my ideas about what happened, and they haunted me. My dad was one of the people who stripped off his clothes and jumped in his boxer shorts and dove down in the ferry dock until they found that boy. And I never forgot it. And it stuck with me all these years. And I've always said, if he'd have been a white boy, we probably would know more about what happened. But he was just a black boy. And it just got swept away. That's heartbreaking for a 12-year-old. And it's very difficult to understand how that can happen. And as I problem, racism is a human problem. And it's everywhere. And that, so I started writing the story. And I knew I couldn't write the real story because his mama's still alive. And God bless her. I love that woman to death. And I don't want to bring her any pain. So I'm not going to do that. So I wrote a different story. But I hit on probably everything that ever happened when I was a kid that I didn't understand. Like why the pedophile down at the marina got away with being a pedophile. And the only thing that ever happened to him was that every now and then a couple of men would go speak to him, in quotation marks. About his predilections, you know, lock him up. Nobody ever did stuff like that. That people are like, well, now we find more predators. No, they were everywhere. They just either the community took care of it themselves and ran them out of town, or they made excuses for them. So that character is in this book. The corrupt judge down at the county courthouse who had like prisoners doing his work at his house. You know, mowing his grass, doing his hedges and stuff like that. He was a tyrant, and he's in this book. You know, there are a lot of tropes in this book. And you know why they're tropes? Because they're true. They're stereotypes because they exist. And that corrupt judge and that sheriff, that Andy Griffith type sheriff that tries to do the right thing but is forced by circumstances to do the wrong things, he's in this book. And then there's the kids who in the 60s and 70s decided that racism wasn't going to be, they weren't going to follow their family histories. That they, you know, they found the Ku Klux Klan outfit up in the attic at grandma's house, you know, and shut the box and never spoke about it and vowed that they would never let that kind of hatred exist in their lifetimes. And yet here we are in 2020 with people wanting to tote around a Confederate flag, not understanding exactly what that means.
So my question to you is the huge number of probably the majority of our listeners who are readers, not writers, what mm-hmm. can they do to see more of the diversity in fiction? Do you have an idea what they could do, or in crime fiction? Or
I tell you, I Google it. Sit down and Google, you know, because the same, and most of our readers are gay or lesbian. And we've talked about this. I use gay to mean everybody. It's just one of those things. We know what to expect when we pick up a book in our niche, but we are less likely to pick up a book outside of our niche that we don't know what's in it. The same thing goes for the heterosexual reader who doesn't want to pick up a gay novel because they think they know what it says. Well, there's a lot of not picking up a black main character detective story because you think you know what it is.
Do you see it as getting any better?
I think it will. I don't think it is. I think it will, if that makes any sense at all. I think we have such a long way to go. We just recently, in the little niche that I'm in, had a big blow up because the authors of color feel underrepresented, and they are underrepresented. And the answer came back, well, we'll just make a special category for authors of color. And that's not what they're asking for. They're asking for a seat at the table. They're not asking for a seat down at the end. They're asking for a seat in the middle of the table. And we need to pull the chairs back and get out of the way. The stereotype is true in lesbian fiction about who's running the show. And I think it's time that some of those reins be handed off to people of color, to people from different cultures, to people who are not American. And also because we're everywhere, we're worldwide, and this is a worldwide niche. I have readers from all over the world. And sometimes my beta readers have been from all over the world, so that I could find out what people in Germany thought about a book that was written about the South. You know, they have a totally different perspective on fascism than we do. And it was very interesting getting that feedback. So we need to open up our minds. We need to open up our bookstores, our publishers. And when you're dealing with being self-published, there's another layer of oppression.
Yeah.
there's a total another layer of oppression. I got into it this year with an award deal because when I sent in my stuff, I put the name of my publisher on there and they put self-published beside me instead of my publishing company. And that's the way it went out to the judges. And I was like, you know, you just stuck me at the bottom of the list.
Mm-hmm.
And that isn't, you know, that there are layers of privilege. There's also layers of oppression. Women are oppressed by some things. Men are oppressed by some things. You know, it's just but in that case, a black or an author of any color other than white is going to be already having doors slammed in their faces and then having that have to being forced to be self-published when you've got a book that should be published by a major house. And I mean, we all feel that way about our work. I understand that, but there are a lot of really good authors of color that are being overlooked. A lot of good stories.
I agree.
One of the things I read a bunch in preparation for this interview, there's Haywood, what's his name? Gar Anthony Haywood. He writes gay fiction as well. And he was saying that there's misguided perception that the market will bear only a small number of books featuring non-white characters because the reading audience is white. Majority of the reading audience is white. And what we have to do is re-educate the audience that they can read outside of their culture, to expand their culture, and to not assume that you already know what this book's going to be about. If you like cozy romances or cozy detective stories, and the main character is black, it's still going to be a cozy detective story, but it's going to be from her point of view and from her culture. So you might learn something, you know?
Well, do you think it's always because they assume they know what a black writer is?
I think it's the same thing I was saying about myself, that, you know, you get comfortable reading what you like. What was it? Stephen Sondheim said, all they really like is what they know. So that is,
I think we reach out for that which is more like us. For example, I'm very close to an individual, a white man, straight though. And he enjoyed my book, but he said, I would never have picked it up if it wasn't written by you. You know, I would pick up something more mainstream. It wasn't prejudicial of him, it was, but it's because his comfort zone is probably about novels that feature detectives or whatever as a straight white male or white female, maybe.
It's like looking, when you look back at your reading past, and you look at all the books you've read in your lifetime, how many of them were written by black authors? And I could actually name most of them, and that is shocking. Morrison, Walker, Angelou, you know, I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings. You know, you can name all of those books that mm-hmm. you were supposed to read, the Langston Hughes books, James Baldwin, all the stuff you were supposed to have read because you were, I was an English major. But I don't, I know that I would have picked up, I picked up everything Alice Walker wrote, Toni Morrison, but the first book had to be handed to me by an English teacher. I wasn't looking for The Color Purple.
Okay, so we're going to have to wrap up here. I want you to give just a real quick final message based on the message that you're trying to get across to what our readers and our writers can do for this change.
Well, some of the things I'd really like to see is I would really like to see publishers make the effort to push the chairs back at the top of the table for writers of color. And also for the gay community and in the major houses, it's time for us to not be the sidekick or the secondary character. It's time for our stories to be told at big publishing houses, and not just the white gay stories, but the black gay stories, the Asian gay stories, all the gay stories, all the beautiful rainbow of gay stories need to be told. And we need to do a better job of making sure that happens. As readers, we need to ask for those books. As authors, we need to open doors and make sure they stay open. As writers, we need to make sure that we're doing the homework and that we're not perpetuating myths, and that we are not continuing dangerous tropes that are not healthy for people. And I'd really like for more people to read Imandari. I believe in this book, and it's more than a mystery. It's a social commentary. And one of the main things I want to make sure I make this point clear. I wanted to make sure that I did not write the book where the white person came in and saved the day for the black people. That is not what happens in this book. People help themselves. Mm-hmm. And I think out of all the messages that come out of this book, it's that we need to set the things right. We need to go back and set things right and do the right thing, even when it's painful, even when it hurts.
Well, Ari, I got to thank you. You certainly have me thinking.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate the time you've spent with me talking about this. It's we are all works in progress.
That we are. Hit the subscribe button wherever you hear our show so you don't miss a single episode. Tell a friend too. Thank you for listening.